coming up on StarStuff. New galactic evolution data shows a dramatic drop in the ratio of spirals to elliptical galaxies over the past 8 billion years. Astronomers find a nearby quasar powered by two supermassive black holes. And red sprites at night, an astronaut's delight. All that and more coming up on StarStuff.
This is StarStuff.
A new study has confirmed most galaxies have changed dramatically over the past 8 billion years. The research, reported in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, compared the types of galaxies found in the universe today with their counterparts 8 billion years ago. One of the study's authors, Professor Andrew Hopkins from the Australian Astronomical Observatory, says the findings show galaxies have undertaken dramatic metamorphoses. About 83% of stars formed since the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago were initially grouped in flat rotating disc-shaped spiral galaxies similar to our own Milky Way. However, only about 49% of stars that exist in the universe today are located in spirals, with the majority in oval-shaped elliptical galaxies. Astronomers reached their conclusions after examining data on 10,000 galaxies in the nearby universe using the Hubble Space Telescope. This was then compared with infrared data on galaxies in the early universe collected by the Herschel Space Telescope, which is sensitive to infrared emissions, in this case, coming from dust within galaxies. You see, the dust is heated up by ultraviolet radiation from young hot stars, and is then re-emitted at infrared wavelengths. By measuring this infrared radiation, astronomers can study stellar populations in distant galaxies, which would normally be obscured by gas and dust clouds, making them difficult to study at optical wavelengths. The Australian Astronomical Observatory's Galaxy Mass Assembly, or GAMMA project, was then used to determine the distances to these galaxies, and consequently their ages. Hopkins says this combination provided scientists with a highly complete census of star-forming populations across the universe. Astronomers found the bulk of stars in the universe today probably formed between 8 and 12 billion years ago. Scientists have long suspected an overall change in the average shape of galaxies from spiral to ellipticals as a result of galactic collisions. However, according to Hopkins, it's the first time scientists have accurately been able to measure the exact extent of this metamorphosis.
There was a lot of work done in the late 1970s with early generations of computers to explore what happens if galaxies collide with each other. And it was realized fairly quickly that if you have two spiral galaxies that collide and merge,
as the Milky Way and Andromeda will be doing in about 3.5 billion years' time,
something like that, that's correct, then what you end up with is the stars within those galaxies getting randomized in their orbits and scattered around in such a way that what you have at the end looks like an elliptical galaxy. The work provides measurements which infer that galaxies that the stars formed in early in the universe were spiral galaxies, but the galaxies that we observe in the nearby universe today actually have most of the stars in elliptical galaxies. And so what that suggests is that the stars are forming while galaxies are in their disk-like or spiral state. And then something happens so that the stars actually end up predominantly in the spheroid bulge elliptical type galaxies. Mechanism is some form of merger process that disrupts the spiral state of the galaxies and turns them into elliptical.
As you look back through time and see galaxies at different phases of their evolution, is that what you're finding?
That's exactly right. The bottom line is that at the very early stages of the universe, something like 83% of the mass in stars has formed in spiral galaxies, but the bulk of the stars today is actually not in those galaxies. It's in the ellipticals. And so it's very clear evidence that says that the stars form in disk-like galaxies, in spiral galaxies, but they end up in elliptical galaxies. And so there has to be a major transformation of spirals into ellipticals after the stars have formed.
And is that where the irregular galaxies come in, these train wrecks of between the two?
Or? The train wrecks, the irregulars, are definitely a phase that happens when galaxies collide. But actually in the early universe, I think a lot the galaxies themselves were a lot smaller.
And closer together.
And their morphologies have just had less time to settle into the regular ordered orbits that are necessary to give you the spiral and elliptical.
Oh, right. So the irregular galaxies came first.
That's correct.
This is in the early universe.
That's right. Yeah, just a few million years after the Big Bang, the majority of galaxies seem to have these irregular morphologies. They're still forming. They're very clumpy. It's the stage of their evolution when the material is coalescing before the galaxies have had time to settle into their more ordered structures. One of the reasons that this is incredibly exciting is that for a long time, people have been talking about the idea of quenching. When galaxies stop forming stars, they somehow change their shape. The idea is that you have a galaxy that is quenched, its star formation ceases, and then somehow that galaxy goes from being blue because of its young stars to being red because it's no longer forming young stars. That's fairly straightforward. But its structure then somehow has to change and become elliptical. And so the mechanism for that, I mean, we have known for many decades, as I said before, about the idea of galaxy interactions changing galaxy structures. But it was unclear in the quenching model the degree to which that needs to be important.
So does this mean the gas that was in those spiral galaxies has been pushed out through galactic collisions?
Most of the gas is likely to actually have been exhausted from the star formation process.
Because there'd be a lot of starburst going on when the galaxies actually collide too, wouldn't there?
That's correct. When two gas-rich galaxies collide, there are a lot of shocks that in turn trigger substantial star formation events, starbursts, as you say. And as part of that process, the gas is either consumed or, again, as you said before, flung out so that what's left is an elliptical galaxy with very little gas and no more ongoing star formation.
Exactly how do the irregular galaxies fit in that picture?
The irregular galaxies are usually lumped in together with the disks and spirals. So in the local universe, it's a fairly small fraction. And so it's usually included in that category for convenience.
Could it be a case of irregular galaxies are formed when they're influenced by other things around them, such as in the early universe, when the universe was physically smaller, things were closer together, would have been a lot of gravitational stresses going on. And of course, now, as we see galactic collisions occurring, we know that that must be causing irregular galaxies.
Yes, that's very true. So at the irregular systems that we see very early stages in the history of the universe are clumpy and they're very clearly undergoing some kind of gravitational collapse at the same time as their stars are forming. And that process, we think, does continue today, but only in the most isolated large void areas where there are no other influences. The very small dwarf irregular galaxies that we're mostly familiar with in the nearby universe happen to be satellite galaxies around much larger spirals or indeed elliptical.
Well, we think the Large Magellanic Cloud used to be a barred spiral, didn't it?
That's exactly right. And you can actually still see the bar if you look at deep images of it. And so the irregular nature of nearby galaxies arises, as you said, much more from their interaction with their neighbours than the formation process, we think, is the origin of that irregular morphology at early times.
You were talking about galaxies in the voids, where there's nothing much around them to influence them, and galactic evolution in the voids tends to be irregular?
Yes, dwarf galaxies and low-mass galaxies and irregular galaxies predominantly at low redshift at late times exist in the voids, we think, largely because there hasn't been an opportunity for that isolated form of evolution to be disrupted by other interactions. Whereas galaxies like our own Milky Way live in a local group of galaxies, and a lot of galaxies live in dense environments, groups and clusters, where their evolution is strongly influenced by the interactions with the neighbouring galaxies in a way that isolated void galaxies don't have. The environmental dependence of galaxy evolution is one of the hot topics in astrophysics research at the moment, trying to understand exactly the degree to which the environment that a galaxy inhabits can influence the speed or the way in which it evolved.
One would have thought that if there's nothing in the way, no nearby influences, as you'd get with a galaxy forming in a void, then the spin would just happen automatically, but that's clearly not the case?
So it depends very much on the local conditions, the feedback effects from the small bursts of star formation that happen as individual isolated clumps of gas self-gravitate and collapse and start that star formation process. One of the challenges in studying dwarf galaxies is that in many cases, the star formation events, even though the individual rates of star formation might be low, compared to the total mass of the galaxy, they form a substantial fraction of that galaxy's stars very quickly, and they have a dramatic impact on the way that that galaxy is evolving. So what we know from looking at the star formation histories of dwarf galaxies is that they're very sporadic. They'll form a burst of stars and then do nothing for a long period of time, and then they'll form another burst of stars and then do nothing for a long period of time. And we think that what's going on there is that when those new stars form, the very massive ones that have very short lifetimes, cosmologically speaking, go supernova very quickly, and the energy injected into the system from those supernovae blows the gas in that system away again. And so the very process of star formation at the same time is preventing...
prevents the vortices forming.
Preventing more stars from forming quickly. And so there's a lot of that kind of sporadic stop-start type of activity happening in isolated galaxies that are not being influenced by their neighbours. And what that ends up doing is producing a system which can look quite irregular because you're seeing the brightest parts from the latest burst of star formation, which then injects a lot of energy and disrupts the system quite substantially before it then regularises again in its next kind of passive phase, if you like.
That's Professor Andrew Hopkins from the Australian Astronomical Observatory. Astronomers using NASA's Hubble Space Telescope have found that Macquarion 231, the nearest galaxy to Earth with a quasar, is actually powered by two supermassive black holes, furiously whirling around each other in the galactic centre. Quasars are powerful jets of focused energy, produced as matter is ripped apart and crushed in the accretion disk of a supermassive black hole. Macquarion 231 is a Seyfert galaxy, located about 600 million light-years away. Seyfert galaxies are quasars in which the galaxy itself can be clearly detected. Usually, quasars are so distant that scientists can't actually see the galaxy which is generating them. Like a pair of whirling skaters, the black hole duo in Macquarion 231 generate tremendous amounts of energy. This makes the core of the galaxy outshine the glow of the galaxy's population of billions of stars. Scientists were looking at Hubble archival observations of ultraviolet radiation emitted from the centre of Macquarion 231 to discover what they describe as extreme and surprising properties. If only one black hole were present in the centre of the quasar, the whole accretion disk made of the surrounding hot gas would glow in ultraviolet rays. Instead, the ultraviolet glow appears to abruptly drop off towards the centre. This provided observational evidence that the disk is a donut hole encircling the central black hole. And the best explanation for this observational data is based on dynamical models that the center of the disk is being carved out by the action of two black holes orbiting each other. The second smaller black hole is orbiting in the inner edge of the accretion disk, and it has its own mini accretion disk and its own ultraviolet glow. The finding not only shows the existence of a close binary black hole pair, but also paves the way for a new way to systematically study binary black holes through their ultraviolet light emissions. The central primary supermassive black hole is estimated to be about 150 million times the mass of our Sun. The less massive companion is about 4 million solar masses. Mind you, that still makes it the same size as the black hole at the center of our own galaxy, the Milky Way. This binary black hole pair are orbiting each other every 1.2 years. The lower mass black hole is clearly the remnant of a smaller galaxy that sometime in the past merged with Macquarion 231. Further evidence of a recent merger comes from the host galaxy's asymmetry and the long tidal tails of young blue stars. The result of the merger has been to make Macquarion 231 an energetic starburst galaxy with a star formation rate some 100 times greater than the Milky Way galaxy today. All the infalling gas fuels the black hole's engine, triggering outflows and gas turbulence that incites a firestorm of starburst. The binary black holes won't stay separate for long, at least not in cosmological terms. They're expected to spiral together and collide, forming a single larger black hole sometime within the next few 100,000 years. NASA has selected a potential next destination for the New Horizons spacecraft in the wake of its historic July flyby of the distant worlds of Pluto and Charon. Mission managers have selected the small Kuiper-built object 2014 MU69, which orbits nearly 1.6 billion kilometres beyond Pluto. The flyby is slated to take place on January 1, 2019. 2014 MU69 is one of two remote Kuiper-built objects identified as possible destinations. Trouble is, both were in opposite directions, and so NASA needed to make a choice. A further evaluation of the target will now be carried out before a final go-no-go confirmation is given. 2014 MU69 was only discovered last year during a search for potential follow-on targets for New Horizons. Astronomers estimate this tiny little body is only about 45 kilometres wide. It orbits the Sun every 293 years at a distance ranging from 46.1 to 42.2 astronomical units. An astronomical unit being the average distance between the Earth and the Sun, which is about 150 million kilometres. Early target selection was important. The team needs to direct New Horizons towards the object this year in order to perform an extended mission with healthy fuel margins. New Horizons will now perform a series of four manoeuvres in late October and early November in order to set its course towards 2014 MU69, nicknamed PT1 or Potential Target 1. The Kuiper Belt is a distant ring of icy debris, frozen rocks and comets circling the Sun beyond the orbit of Neptune. Pluto is simply the largest known object in the Kuiper Belt. Astronomers believe the Kuiper Belt contains, well, I guess you'd call it the builder's rubble left over from the formation of the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. Because of their distance, and unlike asteroids, Kuiper Belt objects have experienced very little cooking by the Sun, and so they're thought to contain well-preserved, deep-frozen material from the solar system's formation. At the moment, New Horizons is about 4.9 billion kilometres from Earth. The spacecraft is healthy and operating normally, and it's continuing the painstakingly slow process of streaming back data to Earth of all the images and other measurements collected during the Pluto flyby. The Expedition 44 crew aboard the International Space Station have been lucky enough to photograph a little-understood phenomenon known as a red sprite above a thunderstorm over the Midwestern United States. The image was captured as the orbiting outpost flew over northwestern Mexico. As the astronauts looked towards the northeast, they saw the blue-white lightning of a powerful thunderstorm and then suddenly the ephemeral flashes of red sprites lighting up the night sky high over Missouri and Illinois, some 2,200 kilometres away. Apart from occasional reports of strange lights seen above thunderstorms by airline pilots, almost nothing was known about sprites or their near relatives, blue jets and elves, until 1989, when scientists studying thunderstorms began picking them up in photographs. Sprites are transient vertical column-like plasma structures, flashing high in the Earth's atmosphere, often in reddish clusters at altitudes of 50 to 90 kilometres. Scientists think sprites are large-scale electrical discharges triggered by positive lightning in an underlying thunderstorm. They're thought to be a form of cold plasma, which makes them far more like fluorescent lights than regular thunderstorm lightning discharges. By the way, positive lightning is a rare type of lightning that occurs in the most severe thunderstorms, originating high in the anvil head of a thundercloud, where lightning's positive charge tends to accumulate. However, instead of discharging with a negative charge at the base of the thundercloud, positive lightning travels outside the cloud, striking the ground directly. Positive lightning is about five times as powerful and hot as negative lightning. It also lasts about 10 times longer. That means it can strike many kilometres away from the storm that created it. And it's what led to the common expression, a bolt out of the blue. The more common negative lightning, which accounts for about 95% of all lightning discharges, occurs either inside the cloud or from the base of the cloud to the ground. Sprites are sometimes preceded by red halo emissions, lighting up about a millisecond before the sprite, about 70 kilometres above the initiating lightning strike. Sprite halos are often described as looking like 50-kilometre-wide flat donut-shaped pancakes, and they're thought to be produced by a weaker version of the same ionisation process that produces the sprites. Sprites' close relatives, known as blue jets, are very bright, narrow cones of plasma seen above thunderstorms at altitudes of 40 to 50 kilometres. Their colours believed to be caused by blue and near ultraviolet emissions from neutral and ionised molecular nitrogen. Scientists still don't know what triggers blue jets, but they're thought to be associated possibly with strong hail activity during a thunderstorm. A closely related phenomenon called blue starters are thought to be a shorter, brighter version of blue jets, only reaching altitudes of 20 kilometres, while another subgroup called gigantic jets appear to be bigger versions of blue jets, reaching 70 kilometres or more in length. ELVs are massive, flattened, expanding reddish glows of plasma 400 kilometres wide, lasting just a millisecond. They've been seen at altitudes of 100 kilometres above thunderstorms. ELVs are thought to be caused by the excitation of nitrogen molecules due to collisions between electrons energised by lightning from underlying thunderstorms. The image taken by the Expedition 44 crew also captured a green airglow band just above the horizon. Airglow is a faint emission of light in the atmosphere. It's caused by the recombination of atoms that were photoionized by the sun during the day, as well as luminescence caused by cosmic rays hitting the upper atmosphere, and chemoluminescence, usually caused by oxygen and nitrogen reacting with hydroxyl ions in the ionosphere. Some of Australia's leading scientific minds gathered in Sydney recently to decide who gets access to some of the country's world-class telescopes, and for how long they have that access. Australia's National Science Agency, the CSIRO, operates a number of radio astronomy observatories that support world-leading research by Australian and international astronomers. The gathering was designed to allow researchers to vie for access time to the telescopes. The ABC's Mandy Sammy reports.
This is basically our science operations centre, so all of our telescopes are operated remotely now.
Dr. Jill Rathbone is the Time Assignment Committee Executive Officer. She's giving me a rare tour of the CSIRO's Astronomy and Space Centre in the northern Sydney suburb of Marsfield.
So we can sit here, or actually for that matter anywhere in the world, and run the telescopes.
It's been a busy week for Australia's Telescope Time Assignment Committee, or TAC. It meets here twice a year behind closed doors to consider telescope applications for 2 6-month periods that begin in October and March. The decisions by the committee can make dreams come true or break hearts.
I love the fact that I can be involved, even superficially, even in the decision, by such incredible science. How could you say no to that? It's so good.
Astronomer Dr. Alan Duffy is one of 8 scientists on the TAC. He and his colleagues have received more than 115 applications for access to Australia's premier radio telescopes. They've been meeting to assess those applications. TAC Executive Officer Dr. Jill Rathbone.
We have a fantastic resource, the telescopes that we run here in Australia. And so we receive about twice as many proposals per semester as we're able to allocate on the telescopes. And so the purpose of the committee is to decide which of those are most compelling and the ones that we have a high priority.
Professor Sarah Madison chairs the TAC. Gaining access to the telescopes is free, and so she says the most important thing is to make sure those who get access deserve it.
So our job is to look through all of the proposals, which cover a really broad range of astronomy topics. So we're ranking for 3 different telescopes, the Australia Telescope Compact Array, the Parkes Radio Telescope, and also the LBA, which is a series of different antennas so you can do very high resolution.
The committee sends its recommendations to the Australia Telescope National Facility. It then notifies both national and international applicants on whether they've been successful gaining access to the telescopes and for how long. If you're thinking you've got a great idea and want to apply to get access to a telescope, astronomer Dr. Alan Duffy has this advice.
Anyone can apply, but you really have to know how to use the telescope, and there's no substitute for experience. At the end of the day, you're going to be up against some of the best scientists in the world trying to do some of the most incredible discoveries potentially. So demand is high and the competition's high.
Astronomer Dr. Alan Duffy ending that report by the ABC's Mandy Sammy. Russia's trouble-plagued Proton-M rocket has returned to flight status following a successful launch from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan.
It's a beautiful clear sky today, daylight launch. We're about L-minus 15 now. And T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we have ignition and liftoff. Liftoff of an ILS Proton from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan with the Inmarsat 5 F3 satellite on board. About 10 seconds after liftoff, the vehicle does do a roll maneuver. We which aligns the launch vehicle pitch axis with the northeasterly launch azimuth. And the vehicle will soon experience maximum dynamic pressure, or max-Q, which is the maximum aerodynamic stress on the vehicle during flight. For Proton, max-Q occurs about 1 minute and 2 seconds after liftoff at a velocity of Mach 1.6. Everything seems to be proceeding nominally as the vehicle ascends over the Cosmodrome in a northeasterly direction with a flight launch azimuth of approximately 61.3 degrees.
The flight carrying the Inmar-5 F3 communications satellite followed the grounding of all Proton rockets after a crash and burn back in May, which resulted in the loss of a Mexican satellite. The May 16 rocket crash was eventually blamed on an engine failure caused by a manufacturing fault. The Russian Federal Space Agency Roscosmos says the flight, which was crucial for Inmarsat, Britain's largest satellite operator, went according to plan. Once operational, the Inmar-5 F3 will provide high-speed mobile broadband communication services. China has launched another military spy satellite, but it wasn't able to keep things on the quiet after bits of the Long March 4C launch vehicle's first stage fell onto the roofs of houses in a local village. Police reported parts plummeted to the ground with a huge roar in Jiayun County in the northern Jiangxi province. No casualties were reported. Pictures show a man standing beside what appeared to be a rocket engine nozzle as tall as himself in front of a cracked wall and with pieces of broken bricks on the ground around. Another image showed a large hole in a red-tiled roof. Local police say the machinery was part of the rocket's propulsion system and they've called on local residents not to panic. What they didn't mention is the fact that the rocket was fueled with a toxic mixture of hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide. The three-stage Long March 4 rocket had lifted off from the Taiyuan launch base in northeastern China's Jiangxi province carrying the Yogan 27 satellite. The official Xinhua news agency reports that the satellite will be used for experiments, land surveys, crop yield estimates, and disaster prevention. However, analysts say the spacecraft is in reality a military spy satellite, which was placed into a 1,200-kilometer high orbit at an inclination of approximately 100 degrees. Now, that places it in exactly the same orbit as other Chinese spy satellites launched in December 2009, in May 2012, in November 2013, and in October last year, all of which were designed to undertake high-resolution imagery optical reconnaissance missions. Beijing views its ambitious military-run multi-billion-dollar space program as a symbol of the country's progress. Problem is, it's not unknown for pieces of rockets to plunge through villages' roofs. Back in 2013, for example, debris from a rocket carrying China's first moon rover plummeted to Earth more than 1,000 kilometers from the launch site, crashing into two homes. And finally for this week, India has launched a new telecommunications satellite using its GSLV rocket. The 2.3-ton GSAT-6 spacecraft was placed into a geostationary transfer orbit 17 minutes after the liftoff from the Satish Dhawan Space Center on India's east coast near the Bay of Bengal. The flight was the third using the GSLV's new liquid-fueled upper-stage engines. The GSLV's main core stage uses a solid-fueled rocket engine. The four strap-on boosters are burning liquid hydrazine, and the upper stage uses a locally developed cryogenic liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen engine that's useful for fine orbital maneuvering. The flight was the third successful launch of an Indian rocket this year. And that's the show for now. Star Stuff's produced by RN Science at the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can ensure that you never miss an episode by subscribing to the show as a free weekly podcast through iTunes. Just type in ABC Star Stuff in the search box and click subscribe. Or you can download the show from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/starstuff. We also have a Star Stuff blog containing all the space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular spacey images and other things I find amusing on the net. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations and publishing details, join the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed. Just type in the @ symbol followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.